1987, and I'm with Ed Breed at MITRE Corporation.
Okay.
But that only means that's so limited. This book.
Well, in the United States, you know,
unless you're a Mormon,
you can have infinite numbers, right?
Right.
They were all Buddhists and they didn't worry about things like that.
Okay.
It was just us Americans who thought that way.
So, can you tell me just a little bit about your background, Ed? Where you went to school and where you were brought up?
Well, actually, I was born in New London, Connecticut. My father was a career Army officer, but my mother lived in that area. We met her there, and so we periodically lived there. I moved around a lot when I was young. Went to 13 grammar schools.
Barney Brandt.
Well, actually, my father was medically retired when I was about 6, but he couldn't stop moving.
Uh-huh.
So he kept moving.
Was this within the United States or worldwide?
No, in the United States, mainly. We lived in Canada for a couple of years, but mostly it was up and down the East Coast of the United States. I ended up back in New Orleans and went to high school there. The Naval Academy.
And when did you graduate from the Naval Academy?
1963.
And took commission in the Army and the Infantry. Okay, and that sort of change of service is unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, well, during the, I'm not sure when it started, but well, certainly a lot, all through the 50s and the 60s, the Air Force Academy recruited a lot of people out of West Point and Annapolis, which they didn't have their own academy.
The Air Force.
And they offered all kinds of great bonuses. They were in the top part of our classes to go into the Air Force. Look today, and then the senior Air Force generals are in fact Naval Academy graduates or West Point graduates. They're from that era. But there, the law that permitted that was written in a general form that says that graduates of one service may be commissioned in another service. They didn't say people from the Army and Navy go in the Air Force. So there were a few leakers who went in opposite directions than what the main thrust of this was. I've forgotten, I think there were 10 people in my class who went to out of almost 900. There were about 3 or 4 of us who went to the infantry.
And was your idea to lead a rifle company in combat? Was that what you wanted to do?
My main objective was that by the time I was, thirds or three quarters of the way through the Naval Academy, I had done an extensive amount of reading about what we then called insurgency and counterinsurgency.
Why not the SEALs?
Well, the SEALs were very, very small then, and in fact, if I remember correctly, they would not allow Academy graduates to be assigned to the SEALs in those days. This was still the pre-Vietnam era. And special forces operations in all the services were looked down upon.
Yeah.
Were not things that regular officers, and certainly not Academy graduates, went to. So, I wanted to be involved in that kind of warfare. I thought that was the big thing. I had studied Spanish, and I had been to several international conferences with Latin American students. It was clear to me, that many of them had communist orientation, interest in nationalism, becoming free of economic imperialism, political imperialism, all those kinds of terminology. There was a general feeling at the time that the communists were making advances in third world countries. They were the conferences in India, you know, of non-aligned nations mm-hmm. and all that mm-hmm. kind of
yeah.
So it seemed to me that if we were going to go to war, and if we were going to fight, that would surely be the place we were going to fight, and that Europe was not ever going to be the battleground. So I had that kind of orientation, and my first thought was actually to go in the Marine Corps.
Well, that would seem...
Because, you know, they're yeah. frequently first to go, and
yeah.
they have the highest 3-4, which is another thing that I was looking for. I thought the services in general had poor morale, poor discipline, not very capable, and that the elite special kinds of forces, like the Marines, the SEALs, and people like that, were better.
Why not the
Well, I went to the senior tactical officer at Naval Academy from the Marine Corps, told him I wanted to go in the Marines. And I had already been to parachute training during the summer vacation with a special class for Naval Academy people. And that, you know, I was high up in my class academically, that I was already parachute qualified, that I was highly interested in insurgency, and I wanted to go to a troop unit and do this, and then I was also interested in going to graduate school for the year after. So he gave me a big long lecture about how you don't come in and tell the Corps that you want anything. The Corps is the Corps, and you give your life and your soul to the Corps, and they decide what the needs are, and they decide what you should do and what you shouldn't do, and they assign you based on what's good for the Marines and good for the nation. And would be happy to have me, but I would understand those are the terms. So I said, forget
it. I take my business elsewhere.
And down the hallway to where the senior army officer was. It was really just a spur of the moment thought. I had never thought about going in. And I thought, well, I'll go in here and see what the deal is here. So I went in and told him the same story, and he said, where would you like to go in the world? Would you be any division you like? Troop duty, and then you can go to any university of whatever caliber you can qualify for. Mm-hmm. Given my class standing, they thought that would be a good school. We'll pay for it through your PhD, and go to West Point and be an instructor, and you can make a career, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounded much better to me than what the Marines had said.
So where did you go?
So I wanted to go to the 82nd Airborne School. They thought I was crazy. They wanted me to go to a tank division in Germany, or maybe go to Korea, or, you know, some exotic assignment. They thought going to North Carolina was supposed to be. But the reason I wanted to go there was I thought the 82nd Airborne Division, from a training and morale and esprit de corps and a specialty kind of orientation, was the closest thing to force recon for Marine Corps, which is what I wanted to do. So I told him I thought the 82nd Division was the best division in the Army, that it was special, that it thought it was special, it acted like it was special, treated people like they were special, had good discipline. And that was the kind of unit that I wanted to be in. They said, okay.
And you became a company commander?
No, I never reached that point. I went down to Fort Benning and went through the infantry officers based force with the West Point graduates. They held us up, the ones of us from the Naval Academy, until West Point was out there and integrated us into a class again. And I went through that, and I went to Ranger School. They went on to jump school, but I had already been there.
Yeah.
So I went straight to the 82nd Airborne Division while they stayed there and went through the parachute training. When I got to the 82nd Airborne Division, I was assigned to the 2nd 501 Battle Group. That division was the last division in the U.S. Army to convert from the Pentagon organization to the Brigade organization, so they still had battle groups there. And I was in normal infantry, 2nd Lieutenant Platoon Leader. After a few months, they called me in, and battle group commander told me, I thought it was a very strange conversation because, you know, it's like anything you didn't know any interest about it, you know, it was a full term. And he told me they were going to reorganize soon and they were going to the brigades and that they wanted me to go to this battalion that was going to be brand new. I guess the way it worked is there were like something like 8 battalions in the old organization and there's going to be 9 in the new one. So they had to form 1 new battalion. Wanted you to go to this new battalion. And he said a close personal friend of his was going to come into the division and be the good battalion commander, and he wanted you to go there and be with him. And he said that he himself was going to become the division chief of staff, and that they wanted my agreement that I would periodically, like every 2 or 3 months, be given a new assignment. And in return for this, they would protect me. Well, I thought that was really strange. I didn't know why a second lieutenant didn't need protection. But I said, sure, that sounds great. I guess anything that was different and unusual appealed to me. And I said, yeah, that sounds great. What is it you really want me to do? And so they said, well, there were a lot of platoons that were unsatisfactory. Of their operational readiness, or in terms of maintenance, or in terms of administration. And that periodically they had inspection teams who came from outside and looked into these matters. And so they knew that they were going to have to do something to fix them. So what their proposition was that 60 to 90 days before an inspection, when the unit was due for inspection, they would relieve the commander.
Yeah.
And I would take it over.
Yeah.
And after the test, they would take me out of it again.
Yeah.
And I would take over another one.
And this is, so you were going to be protected from maybe some
from all the
people who you employed.
Yeah. All of them were, well, I was the second lieutenant, so most of them were first lieutenants and captains.
I see.
They figured this wasn't going to go down well around the organization.
Yeah.
But that's what they wanted to do, and I said to myself, I said, you know, I get a lot of different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always be in a unit that was about to get inspected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
So I agreed.
How long did that last?
The whole time I was in the division almost. I was a Davy Crockett platoon leader, which was a nuclear short-range missile that they had at the time. I was a reconnaissance platoon leader. I was a support and transportation platoon leader. That was a platoon full of trucks. He worked for the S-4.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not put in charge of the headquarters company, but the headquarters company was a large company,
mm-hmm.
a couple hundred people. And when they were due for their admin inspection, they told the company commander to stay in his office and leave me alone, and I would fix his company for him. I spent 2 months in the headquarters company getting it in shape and passed the inspection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just redid everything. I trashed all the records, start all over.
Yeah.
The thing was a mess. That happened in Asia for a long time.
I wouldn't see where, quite frankly, the protection would be possible.
Well, what they did was, in a legal sense, the battalion commander was always my rating officer. So I had a lieutenant colonel as the writer of my performance review, and the school colonel was the endorser. So by the time I left the 82nd Airborne Division, I don't remember the numbers, but I was there like 22 or 23 months, and I had 11 performance reviews because there was an Army regulation that says every time you change this assignment, performance reviews shall be written. So I had 11 or whatever it was, performance reviews, all max score except for TAC. I always failed TAC-fulness. So I always had one low grade and max everything. I never was able to be diplomatic when I was young. So I got a lot of good experience. At one point, I was also the battalion adjutant. What this battalion commander did was he decided, he was very short-handed. It's a long story. We only had half as many officers as we were supposed to have assigned at the time. And so he took the three or four experienced captains he had and made them company commanders. He took two or three second lieutenants who he thought were really good and he put them on his staff instead of the captain. So he took the junior officers, he took the senior officers in the company. And that's the way he ran the battalion. It was pretty shrewd.
Yep.
So then that set up, I was the battalion adjutant. In fact, it was kind of unusual because I lived off post with two other second lieutenants. And both of them were picked for the battalion staff too. So all three of us lived together off post and we were all on the battalion staff. One of them was the assistant S3, I was the S1, the other one was the S4. So except for the commander, we sort of had the battalion headquarters sewed up off post.
Yeah, in your... Sounds like a... David Niven movie. So, when did you go to Vietnam?
They went to Santo Domingo. The division went to Santo Domingo while I was still there. The guy who was the assistant S3 and myself were already on orders to go to Vietnam. And our battalion commander, he was picked to be the lead battalion going to Santo Domingo. But he went to the division commander and told him he couldn't deploy. I said, why not? He said, I'm not combat ready because I don't have Lieutenant Brady and Lieutenant Gilhouse. I said, what do you mean you don't have them? He said, well, they're on orders to Vietnam, so they're non-deployable. So he said, deploy me. So he came back and he made me the reconnaissance instead of the adjutant. The guy said, you know, if we go to San Domingo, I don't need a goddamn adjutant. What I need is the reconnaissance. Mm-hmm. So he reassigned me again.
Is that what you did?
And so I commanded the reconnaissance team when we went to San Domingo.
Let's skip along to Vietnam.
Right. So I left San Domingo and came back. Fort Bragg, went through the military advisor school, and went to Vietnam. I had spent well over a year arranging my assignment to Vietnam. Almost every Monday morning I was calling the Pentagon and lining up what I wanted as an assignment.
And you wanted to be an apprentice school ranger? I wanted to be ranger.
A ranger advisor, yeah. And I ended up doing that. Went to the 22nd Ranger Battalion, which was based in Lake Two at the time.
And when did you go?
In August of 65. Which was just when the first units were arriving, that they decided to have a build-up. And I think, if I remember correctly, the 173rd Airborne Brigade moved into that area from Okinawa, either just before I got there or right after I got there, and that was the first thing drawing me.
So you were part then of Mac Lee as an advisor.
Yes.
And did you, was there a province system?
The entire time I was there.
Was there a province setup that you were in then at that point?
No. The provinces were part of MACD, but they were separate. There were advisors to the Vietnamese Army, and there were advisors to the districts and the regions.
Right. Okay.
Districts, province, regions.
Okay.
And I was on
the
northern side.
Okay.
So this battalion, there were three battalions up there, and they were all assigned as Corps Strategic Reserve. That was their mission. And I was assigned to them. And we saw a lot of combat. Did a lot of things because during 65 in the Highlands, the NDA was building up rapidly. Mm-hmm. Tuesday reporting there were no NDA there. And all kinds of things that were called.
Mm-hmm.
But the classic kind of thing we did was we had one of three missions. Either had what was for us a relatively dull mission, which was to open up a road somewhere and let them take convoys through for two or three days to reapply, to resupply the province and capitals and things like that where the DC would cut them off and they had the roads to close because they were insecure. Or they had regular army units in trouble somewhere, and they would throw us in the reinforcements. And those were usually where we took heavy casualties. So there's some kind of tactical emergency someplace in the core area, and the regular army is suffering, not winning, and they would move us in the reinforcements. Or the other thing that went on a lot in those days was special forces camps were constantly getting surrounded by these MDN units and literally being laid siege to. And so if a few weeks went by and the special forces couldn't solve this problem, they would ask for reinforcements to break the siege, and they would send the Rangers in, depending on where it was, if they could get there by road, a couple of ATC companies. Were also in the Corps Reserve, sort of break through from behind, break through the MDA units and get into the camp and let the camp people out. And so we did that a lot.
How many advisors were there with the 22nd Marine Battalion?
Two officers and a sergeant. I was the junior advisor. There was normally a captain. And by then I was a junior first lieutenant. So there was a captain, a first lieutenant, sergeants. That was the standard advice.
And were they all Army?
They were all Army.
Not Special Forces?
They were all Army. The officers were all Rangers. Trained people from the Ranger School.
Did you have any anti-infrastructure kind of mission at all?
These were regular operations.
Was there any awareness back then that there wasn't infrastructure that should be...
Well, you know, I think people like myself, certainly, who had read, you know, about insurgency, or you know, people like Comer, who I didn't know then, Bob Comer, who were working with the White House, or Douglas Pike, who was writing books, you know, people like that knew that there was a Communist Party and that this is what the real problem was. That, you know, the problem was, by 65, Vietnam was in many areas not a guerrilla war.
Right.
And so, you know, the insurgency theory that everybody was operating under was really not a practical thing to be talking about. We were had NVA battalions and NVA regiments to contend with in the II Corps, and certainly the same is true in I Corps. And I don't remember when they appeared in III and IV Corps, but it was shortly thereafter or about the same time.
I don't think they're ever really in IV Corps. Not to my knowledge, is there ever really a main force war?
Yeah, I guess that's probably true.
But everywhere else.
So, you know, you had the main force war, if you want to call it. You had the VC guerrillas, and then you had the Communist Party. So you had three different problems. And lots of the guerrillas, or at least the guerrilla leaders, belonged to the Communist Party. But then there was another whole set of people in the Communist Party who were district chiefs, you know, a shadow government, in effect. Tax collectors, administrators, district chiefs, the whole nine yards, who were not guerrilla leaders.
But your so awareness of that.
I knew about that.
You knew, you did know. This was something you were aware of.
I had read about it. I didn't have any first-hand experience other than talking to the Vietnamese officers who were in the battalion about, you know, how is this really organized, what really goes on, what are the real problems. Other than that, all I had some knowledge was what I had read about other countries, you know, the Malaysian insurgency, Latin America things, Che Guevara. I'd read all those things before London, Regis the Grey. My theory, see, when I was young, was that if you want to understand what the other side is doing, you should read what they write.
That's right.
Yes. Not what we write.
Yeah.
So the things that were available in English, like Che Guevara's work, Regis de Grey's work, Mao Tse-tung, that stuff, I read all that stuff.
Okay, so is that a 12-month tour with the Rangers? And do you re-up for a second one?
Well, what they normally did was most of the officers were there 6 months. They rotated assignments for most of the officers between Vietnamese military units and whatever more administrative jobs, either in the MACD headquarters itself, mm-hmm. the U.S. part of it, or as an advisor to the districts or the provinces. So most people, you know, would spend 6 months with an Arvin battalion, 6 months in a province, or 6 months in MACD headquarters on staff.
So what did you do in your second 6 months?
I stayed in the Ranger
Company. Stayed in the Ranger.
I don't remember how long it was for. 14 months, 15 months, something like that.
Okay.
So initially, you know, when the 6 months came up and they said they wanted me to take another assignment, and I told them no, I didn't want to, nobody said anything, they just said sure. But after about 9 or 10 months, I guess it was, we had been in so many battles and had so many casualties that every time the senior advisor flew out to where the action was, after it was over, you know, give out medals or congratulate people or see what had happened himself, he was always saying, great, you know, you got to get reassigned somewhere else. You can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
And I was always very fortunate because I was never scratched. I was never sick, I was never wounded, and obviously I was never killed. But a number of the captains who I worked for were killed or were medevac during combat operations, so, you know, people began to get nervous, like, you know, how many times is he going to do this?
Superstition.
Everybody else is medevac, right. He's still out there.
Make him a captain.
And there were several operations that I went on where, you know, like maybe there'd be 12, 14 officers all together from different battalions, and I'd be the only one by the time it was over who wasn't medevaced or killed in the action.
Mm-hmm.
So after a couple of those, you know, people started to talk. The two U.S. sergeants that we had refused to work with me. Mostly what we did in these things in combat operations was direct airstrikes. A lot of the air was U.S. air. The Vietnamese Air Force hadn't been built up much yet, that came later. So most of the air support came from U.S. planes, and so the American advisors were the key link to the airstrikes.
Would that be not through MACD, but through the division, the corps that was there?
Well, that's the Vietnamese Corps. There was an advisory team, it was called the Direct Air Support Center, that was with the Corps, that was U.S. Air Force.
Right,
and they had facts.
Yep.
That flew over the operation, so we were on the radio to the facts, and the facts would be on through the Air Force chain to call for close air support sorties out of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Air Force. But they were not literally, they were not actually a part of MACD. They were there to support the MACD operation.
Right.
So I always felt that, you know, you couldn't direct an airstrike well if you couldn't see.
Mm-hmm.
So I would always go to where you could see. So that was normally in front of the troops, in front of the front lines.
Yeah.
And the sergeants didn't like that.
That's why they didn't want, because
so
you would drag one or two of them along with you.
Yeah. Well, when you got them on the end of the wire, and you have the handset, and they have the radio, and you're dragging them around all the time. So after that, after they told me that that's what was their problem, the Vietnamese carried my radio. I never used to be a sergeant.
Were you developing
language? So they
had a
Vietnamese corporal who was assigned to me. He cooked for me. He cooked all my food. I didn't eat any U.S. food. I only eat Vietnamese food. So he carried my extra equipment. He cooked my food and he carried the radio. And that's who I learned Vietnamese from, was his corporal. He couldn't speak English. And so he was determined that I was going to be able to speak to him, and he taught you, I mean, just by the way you teach a baby, you know, he'd point at this, and he'd say whatever it was, and make me say it until I could say it, and he'd point at that. So I just gradually built up a vocabulary. We were out in the field 20, 25 days out of a month, so it was a lot of time for it. And, you know, by the time I left the Ranger Battalion, I was pretty fluent about anything that was a military-related thing.
Yeah.
You know, if it was tactics or weapons or words about the VC or equipment or things like that, I could speak about anything like that.
Things that were relevant to you at the moment.
Yeah, if somebody said to me, how's the weather today, I probably wouldn't know what to say. But if they said, you know, have you got 6 machine guns, I knew what that was. That's the kind of thing it was.
But as inevitably you had to leave the Ranger Battalion, and what was your next assignment?
I went to Dalat, which was considered to be one of the garden spots of Vietnam, as a province advisor, which I looked upon as a vacation. By the time I had 15 months in the battalion, and people were insisting that I get reassigned and I needed a vacation, I thought a good vacation would go be in a province advisory team.
Now, is this also, is this the MACV province advisor? This is not the civilian again?
Well, the thing is in the provinces, there was technically two separate organizations, a civilian province and a military sector. These geographically coincided, and the same person headed both of them, a Vietnamese colonel. So the colonel, who was the sector commander, was also the province chief. There were no civilian province chiefs. The military had total control of the country. So it would be in the United States like all the state governors being major generals.
I understand. Okay.
And they had two parts to their staff. They had some civilian staff who were province people, and they had military staff who was their military sector advisor. So we were assigned to support the sector team.
Okay.
And I was assigned to be the operations advisor. So there was an operations officer who supported the colonel, and I was there to help
him. Is this mostly rough puff kind of stuff?
In this province, there were no Harbin forces assigned. So it was all regional force population.
Not one of those generals didn't have a division there or something like that. Okay.
Both the VCE and Harbin tried to avoid military operations a lot.
Gentlemen's agreements, for instance?
It was a sort of a form of accommodation. It was kept as a vacation spot, a neutral city where you could have meetings, where lots of financial transactions could take place, illegal and legal. It was a place where the DC could raise money and wash money and change money because of its neutral status. It was sort of like what I think Geneva was like in World War II.
Did the province chief
they knew
prosper
about
as a result of this accommodation?
Sure.
Who was his?
There was a lot of things in the province, like wood cutting and rubber plantations and tea plantations and things like that. There were lots of sources of money, both for the VC and for the South Vietnamese.
Economic opportunity.
Yeah. And neither side wanted to upset that.
Was Frank Wisner in Dalat at that time? Do you remember who the... What, did they have an American province senior advisor at that point?
Oh, yeah. But... In the lot at the time that I was there, if I remember correctly, the senior advisor was an American colonel who advised the military. And they were, well, there was a USIA advisor there, because there was a Voice of America station there. And there was a CIA senior advisor there.
Yeah, province office.
But I don't remember any other civilians.
Did you, was the...
This was pretty early in the buildup.
Yeah, this is 1966, right?
Yeah, this was the fall of 66.
That's the beginning of it.
There.
Right.
So,
and that's the big FOCO reorganization.
Right, when you look at, senior civilians in each province and everything, that started to come a little bit later. There was no real CORDS organization then.
Right, there was the Experimental Office of Civilian Operations.
Yeah.
And
they had people in a few places, but not in this province.
Not in this province, okay.
The other unusual feature about this province, though, was they had a National Police Training Center there that was brand new. And they had a USAID advisory team that was headed by an Australian Brigadier General who had retired.
Brigadier Sarong.
Sarong.
I know a lot about him. I interviewed the guy who was the head of the field forces.
Oh, really?
Colonel Greaves, who became Sarong's adversary for control of that organization.
Sarong was the best guy who ever worked here.
Yeah.
Problem, they should have made him the boss.
So you got to know Brigadier Sarong?
We can read what he wrote. Okay. One night Sarong and I got into a discussion and told me that the Americans didn't understand guerrilla warfare, and they didn't understand what this was all about, and they didn't understand how to train, and they didn't understand how to fight, and they didn't know how to deal with the Vietnamese. And Dave, as one example of how, if he were doing things, they would do better. That he had these known guards that he hired themselves and that guarded these village things, how well trained they were, etc. So I said, well, I don't know, it may be true in general, but I don't think that applies to all Americans.
Really?
And so he said, well, you made the exception, but I don't know. And so that night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I climbed over the wall in his building and went through his known guard in his house. And I woke him up in his bedroom with a .45 up against his temple.
My father was...
And he changed his whole view.
Yeah. My father was in a prison camp in World War II where it was, and British, and he was the only American. So I've learned a lot about Australia.
I don't know what they told you about Sarong, but Sarong has a fantastic background. Sarong was
what I know about
These desert rat patrols in the Middle East in World War II, these machine gun mounted jeep things that roamed all over and harried the German forces from the rear and the sides and the flanks. He commanded one of those.
Okay.
And then when that phase of the action died down, he went, I believe it was, to Borneo.
Okay.
And he commanded a Australian commando battalion in the rear of the Japanese in Borneo. And then he went to Australia and built their jungle warfare training center and led that. He may have had other assignments in between, but this is the pertinent stuff I know about. And then when the Malaysian insurgency broke out, he was seconded to the British and went to Malaysia. And he built the training center for the jungle constabulary, which was a key part of how the British dealt with the insurgency in Malaysia. And he was key to the training of the jungle constabulary. And he and Sir Robert Thompson, and I think the other guy's name was Palmer, but I've forgotten, George Palmer, I believe, were three of the key guys over there for many, many years. That went on for 12 years.
Desmond Palmer?
Desmond Palmer, right. And so that was the background that USAID hired him for.
Yep, for that field force.
To set up the field force and then set up the training center and to run it.
So then you...
I was there in the sector. I knew him well. Mm-hmm. And there was a CIA guy there, province officer, who I got to know well. And I don't know, I'd been there a few months, I guess, and I'd had enough vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I was rested and eager to do something different, but there wasn't a lot of combat going on in this province, because it was kind of a neutral thing. I was learning a lot of new Vietnamese from the officers I was working with. I was learning all the words about money and corruption, and learning a lot of politics and economic terms and stuff like that. So my language capabilities was vastly expanding, and my knowledge about Vietnam and how it really operated was vastly expanding.
And
Sarong asked me one time, would I be willing to go on loan to his team? And that they had a new kind of platoon that they were bringing up to the training center that they wanted trained in small squad tactics and ambushes and more like guerrilla warfare kinds of things than what the police did. And would I be willing to train this platoon, because he didn't think that the Australian warrant officers that he had there were the right people. They were more into police kinds of things. So I said, sure. So he talked some general in Saigon into making my colonel, U.S. colonel, let me do this instead of my job.
Yeah.
And so I spent a couple of months full time at the training center training this platoon. Well, it turns out this platoon was the first experimental PRU unit, Provincial Reconnaissance Unit, which was recruited by the CIA, and ultimately every province had one, and they were the action arm of the province officers.
Yeah.
This was the first one. And this thing was really the strangest thing you'd ever saw in your life.
Let's backtrack a sec. This is sort of very interesting to me, okay? I understood that Sarong was on contract to the agency. So were you actually then contracted?
No, or in the U.S. Army, you signed MACV, loaned by some arrangement in Saigon.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just a low-level guy who was, you know, interested.
Yeah.
There were a lot of rumors that Sarong was not really a USAID employee, he was really a CIA employee.
That's the way I understand it.
I don't know what he really was. I don't know whether USAID Public Safety Program was running this training for field police. That was their job. That was the public safety director's job to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was very hard to tell if you were down on the bottom in those days who was who and where'd they get their money from,
yeah,
and whether that was a cover story and was really a CIA operation.
That's the way it's explained to me by it.
Very hard to know. I mean, Sarong's story was that he was a USAID employee.
Mm-hmm.
And it fit. I mean, that was a USAID responsibility to train the public police.
That's right.
That was a public police training center.
Mm-hmm.
He was running the training center.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as far as I know, he may have had a few political meetings with Vietnamese passing through the province because lots of big wheels came there.
Yeah.
But he didn't do anything other than train police.
And Peru.
But Peru came later.
Okay. But now, where does the name Peru come from? Do you know who thought up that name? I have no idea about that.
When I started training these guys, they didn't have any name.
Were they being referred to as counter-terror units?
No, nothing. I mean, they just said they had this new platoon, and they wanted to train them. And it was an experiment to see how it would go. And he wanted me to be the trainer. That's how I got into the story. I didn't know anything else about it than that. I don't know who planned it, who got the idea, where it came from.
Okay.
But my suspicion is that Bob Comer knows, and that Bob Comer was probably involved in it. I hadn't met Comer yet. And this platoon had three squads in it. Four squads. Two of them were gnomes and two of them were mountain yards. They couldn't speak to each other. There was a squad leader and a platoon commander, all of whom were officers who were Vietnamese from the Vietnamese Special Forces, who could not speak mountain yard or gnome. So in this platoon of 43 people or what it was, there were three separate languages spoken. None of them spoke English.
Yeah.
And none of them spoke to each other. And so the first day was really a revelation to me when they said, here's your group, now train them.
Yeah. Talk about your mixed commando units.
Well, I was fluent in Vietnamese by then, so I could talk to the officers.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they couldn't speak English didn't bother me. But that was obviously one of the reasons, in retrospect, why I was picked to be the training officer. Because nobody else in the command could speak to them.
Okay.
So I taught them basic small unit tactics, mostly through demonstrations and hand-in-arm signals. They had all been trained in Army hand-in-arm signals. And so by communicating through arm and arm signals, we got the basic idea. We'd run through it a few times. We'd tell them no. We'd move them around. We'd walk through it. They all began to get the idea. And it was kind of interesting because this was one of my first-hand experiences with the guerrillas and the infrastructure.
Were you also reporting to the CIA province officer on progress or?
Well, he used to come to dinner, but I didn't think I was reporting to him. I didn't even know that he was involved. I thought we were all just friends.
Because, I mean, ultimately it was going to be his outfit, right?
Yeah. I believe the name of the province officer was Peter Stowe. But, you know, they did strange things, and sometimes I went along with them. It was all like a group of friends who were helping each other out. There was never any arrangements. There was never anything explicit said. There was never anything, you know, would you work for us or would you be on our payroll or anything that was like that. It was the group that had dinner together almost every night, and it was me